had almost nothing to do with Freud. Mann began by saying that the real achievement of Freud was that he had, through his researches, reproduced in medical terms all the findings of the German Romantic philosophers of the 19th century, even though Freud had never read any of these. He did not know Schopenhauer, says Mann. He did not know Nietzsche. He did not know Søren Kierkegaard. And yet, out of his own ignorance, on his own boat, he had reproduced the whole thing. Then he said, "Now, if you will pardon me for talking about myself, I will show that in my works, long before I heard of Freud, I was already working in this mode." And then he spoke of his own early short story, Der kleine Herr Friedman, Little Mr. Friedman. This was published in 1896 or 1897, 3 or 4 years before Freud's interpretation of dreams. And it's a fact that in that little story you get a good deal of Freudian information, or the information that Freud produced also in another language and with a totally different slant. About halfway through the lecture, Mann mentioned the unutterable name, Jung, and how Jung inspired the works that he was doing now, which was his Joseph novels. He had just then finished Volume 3. I can't imagine what went on in that room while he was doing this. Now, I bring this up because it is a very good lead-in to the whole context of what was going on in the realm of unconscious research in the first half of the century. This was a wonderful period in the arts. Joyce and Mann, completely ignorant of each other, simultaneously went through a transition in their novels, in their writings, from what might be called 19th-century naturalism through the psychological accent given in their works to a breakthrough in myth. Then the First World War comes along, 1914 to 18, and immediately after it, these epical works appear. Joyce's Ulysses in 1922, Mann's Magic Mountain in 1924. And both of these pretended to be naturalistic works, but they were structured on a mythological base. And the mythological structure was given to you in a cue in the title, Ulysses and The Magic Mountain. Then they slide right into the whole sea of myth in their next great works, Thomas Mann's Joseph novels and James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. The contrast between Joyce and Mann is interesting. Joyce was an Irish Catholic, and Thomas Mann had been brought up a German Protestant. Insofar as you take the religion seriously, you're living in immediate relationship to myth. And the problem, then, is to relate your experiences when you move into the world to this mythological ground, to see the world in terms of those structures which have been put into you in the beginning. Thomas Mann comes the other way around. One of the characteristics of Protestantism, I would say, is that it rejects the ritual and mythological interpretation and accent in the religion. And so Mann comes gradually into a realization of the mythological depths and what they implied. It took him a long time. This gave Joyce a kind of advantage in that he was a professional in mythological thinking, right from infancy, and Mann comes gradually into it. And this makes the two of them an extraordinarily interesting pair to bring together. In The Magic Mountain, Thomas Mann is continually explaining the implication of his mythology. He gives you the image, and there is an interpretation that's given you one way or the other. Joyce does nothing of the kind. Joyce just gives it to you, bing, like that, and you've got to work into it. So I have always found in my own reading and thinking about these matters that these two men complement each other in an extraordinarily interesting way. Their approach to art is also interesting. In their backgrounds are the German philosophers of the 19th century. Wagner, of course, was a very important influence in the years of their growing up. Both of them took some themes from Wagner. One of the musical devices Wagner used is that of the leitmotif, the returning echo, the cliché that is associated with a certain body of meaning and system of associations that recurs, and every time it recurs, the whole meaning of it comes back again in new relationships. For Thomas Mann, this was a device, and anyone who has read Mann's Buddenbrooks, for instance, or any of his early short stories, has recognized this. When he mentions a character, he will always mention some little context of adjectives or commentary that he has mentioned before with respect to this character. So the whole thing comes in again as the leitmotif. Joyce, who is a very musical person, also used the musical device as a recurrent refrain. One of the great disappointments of his life was that in a singing contest in Dublin he didn't win. John McCormick won. Now, the trick for the artist is to present his material so that it doesn't put a ring around itself and stand there as separate from you, the observer. And that aha that you get when you see an artwork that really hits you is, I am that. I am the radiance and energy that is talking to me through this painting. In purely empirical terms, it's called participation. But it's more than that. It's identification. Now, what Mann tried to do when he turned to mythology was to reinterpret Genesis in terms of the elementary ideas that are implicit in the ethnic ideas of the Bible. It's a very important work, and it's the only way to translate the Judeo-Christian heritage into a heritage for mankind instead of for a certain group. Do you get my point? It's a big one. This is what Mann is working on. This is what Jung is working on. This is what Joyce is working on. This is what everyone is working on who is trying to retain the positive values that are in this heritage and at the same time move into a global period of life where we don't isolate ourselves and say everybody else is worshiping devils. Now, what we must come to find is how the artist, how Joyce, how Mann, has broken through and rendered this mystery. One way is through the rhythms of their prose. This is a problem of poetry. The poet is breaking you past the image, breaking you past the words, so that things should point past themselves. Rhythm has a lot to do with this. I happen to know the woman responsible for bringing the Mann family over here, Mrs. Eugene Meyer. She was the wife of the owner of the Washington Post in those days. When I recognized that Hans Castorp's dream was a repetition of the last paragraph of Nietzsche's The Birth of Tragedy, I asked Mrs. Meyer if she had recognized this and if Mann had ever spoken to her about it. She said, "I'll ask Tommy next time I see him." About 3 weeks later, I got a letter from her saying, "I asked him about the scene from The Birth of Tragedy and he was stunned. He had never realized what he had done." This is known as cryptamnesia. The brain doesn't forget things, but your attention may be so far away from that you will have forgotten, but there it is. And if you read the last paragraph of The Birth of Tragedy, you'll be stunned too.
Joseph Campbell, Mythos 3, The Shaping of the Western Tradition.
And so here is the secret of Mann's art, the absolutely ruthless eye which sends the arrow of the correct word to name the fault, and on the arrow is an ointment of love. This he calls erotic irony. He also calls it plastic irony, and it's the secret to Thomas Mann's art. Now, the function of art, and it was Shakespeare who said it, is that art holds up the mirror to nature. Art holds, you might say, a holographic mirror up to nature, so that you can see that in this object is the totality. Each is a totality in itself. And this is the way these men deal with their characters. It was Schopenhauer who was the first to bring Oriental terminology into Kantian thinking. Here at the beginning of the 19th century, we have this synthesis of the two philosophies. It then became possible for writers like Mann and Joyce to take in the whole enrichment of the Oriental understanding of transcendence and the Maya aspect of personality, how it's all an illusion based on the mirror images of time and space, and render it purely in Occidental terms. This notion of what might be called psychological or spiritual morphology informed all these works. Yeats has the same thing in his thinking and writing. At the same time, you have Schopenhauer opening up the whole story of the unconscious, and Freud then coming along and turning it into medical terms. This is a great, great moment.
Tarnas, that reminds me of one of your favorite expressions, being transparent to the transcendent.
A couple of years ago, I learned of a great German psychologist. His name is Karl Fried Graf Durkheim, and he has a center in the Black Forest, the Schwarzwald, not far from Freiburg. So I went back to Germany last September, 1981, after 52 years. That was a gamble. And I had the pleasure of an hour with this wonderful man who is just about 85 years old now. He said the whole problem of life is to become transparent to transcendence, so that you realize that you are yourself a manifestation of this. that you live the myth, that you live the divine life within you, yourself as a vehicle, not as the final term, but as a vehicle of consciousness and life. This is the great theme that I find here. Transparent to transcendence. When that came into my vocabulary, it just seemed to be the only thing necessary. My definition of myth now is a metaphor transparent to transcendence. To me, he is the pole star.
Tarnas, could you talk about exactly what transparent to transcendence means?
Mythology opens the world so that it becomes transparent to something that is beyond speech, beyond words, in short, to what we call transcendence. If the metaphor closes in on itself and says, I'm it, the reference is to me or to this event, then it has closed the transcendence. It's no longer mythological. It's distortion. It's pathological. The energies of the universe, the energies of life that come up in the subatomic particle displays that science shows us are operative. They come and go. Where do they come from? Where do they go? Is there aware? The ultimate ground of being transcends definition, transcends our knowledge. When you begin to ask about ultimates, you are asking about something that transcends all categories of thought, the categories of being and non-being. True, false, these are, as Kant points out in the Critique of Pure Reason, functions of our mode of experience. And all life has come to us through the aesthetic forms of time and space, and the logical ones of the categories of logic, so we think within that frame. But what is beyond? Even the word beyond suggests a category of thought. So transcendence is literally transcendent, of all knowledge. In the Kina Upanishad, written back in the 7th century BC, it says very clearly, that to which words and thoughts do not reach. The tongue has never soiled it with a name. That's what transcendent means. And the mythological image is always pointing toward transcendence and giving you the sense of riding on this mystery. And in Aikido or winning a race, you are riding on that. That's the mysticism of athletics. And the mysticism of love is the riding of the two. They really are one, only they look like two. And the experience is the experience of a truth. An intuitive experience that disregards time and space. Schopenhauer has a wonderful paper he calls The Foundations of Morality. That's the one where he asks, how is it that a human being can so participate in the danger of another that, forgetting his own self-protection, he moves spontaneously to the other's rescue? How come, when the first law of nature is self-preservation, that is dispelled? His answer is that this is a metaphysical impulse that is deeper than the experience of separateness. You realize you and the others are one, and the experience of the separateness is simply a function of the way we experience in the field of time and space. This is the realm to which myths apply, the realm that is a fundamental reference, and it's no realm at all. When the Zen masters talk about things on this level, they say, that which is and is not that. They just erase the word immediately. Or the void of sunyata, the void that is no void, but a pleroma, a fullness. You go past the pair of opposites. Within the field of normal life concerns, we don't have to worry about those things. But when you really are at a fighting point, the sharp life point, and a life crisis comes and it's major, you'd better get in that position or you won't be able to take it. My friend Heinrich Zimmer used to say the best things can't be said. This is one of them. The second best are misunderstood. That's because the second best are using the objects of time and space to refer to transcendence. And they are always misunderstood by being interpreted in terms of time and space. The third best? That's conversation. We're using the third best in order to talk about the first and second best.
Arian, I'm thinking now of that really beautiful Basque myth about the mermaid who would swim only in the lighted waters of the sun, and gradually the sun fell in love with her. He stuck out his tongue, which was a beautiful rainbow, and pulled her up to him. And when they unified, there were 7 teardrops of joy. Then he spit her back, and she became a huge shooting star that grew and grew to become the moon. Now, during twilight, you see neither the sun nor the moon, because once again, they are unifying. but you see all their children, which are the stars.
That is a sweetheart.
That's transcendent.
It's a beautiful one. Where does it come from?
That's Basque.
A Basque myth? We always knew they were wonderful people. Isn't it wonderful when you hear a little myth like that? I've never heard it before, but you know it's mythological. You could have heard it from three or four other cultures, only you didn't. You didn't, but you could have. It's talking from a certain center of the imagination and symbolization that has a quality that is the mythological quality. And it does not come out of intentional fiction. It comes out of some kind of metaphorical way of speaking about a beautiful life truth of some kind.
Audience question. You talk about being transparent to transcendence, but I think that the issue is that some people don't see themselves as being transparent. They see themselves as being opaque, and that's ego inflation. And that's where they get confused, and that's also the problem.
I always get a message from somebody, and this is a good one. Yes, it's lovely. I'm not quite transparent. It's the who that is the I. The thing the Hindu teachers tell you is you can't say Atman, the transparent self, as long as the I that you're referring to is the phenomenal one. Then it's better to be irreverent. So you might say that Judaism and Christianity are popular religions. They're religion on the popular level for the people who are not yet ready to recognize the transcendent within themselves. They ought to be a little more available than they are to the opening of the door to transcendence.
Brown, what role does psychology play in contemporary myth? And how can myth help a psychiatrist or someone who goes in for therapy?
What the psychologist is finding out about the structure of the human psyche, that is what is most relevant to mythology. Because mythology has to do with relating that psychological structure to the circumstances of objective life in the world today. It gives you a clue. It's a signal system. The images of myth are not fact, they are metaphors, and the reference is to transcendence. They take the facts of life and relate them to the psyche. This double relationship is then shown to the mystical function to rest on, what do you want to call it, the void, the fullness, the pleroma. Those are words that point past what can be conceived of, and they make the point that this whole marvelous universe that we now know of, billions of galaxies, is on the void. No one knows where those little subatomic particles come from or go to that flash on the screen. Lives also come and go, and they are spirits within the field of time and space and causal relationships. That's what we find. The myth has to deal with the cosmology of the day, and it's no good when it's based on a cosmology that's out of date, and that's one of our problems. I don't see any conflict between science and religion. Religion has to accept the science of the day and penetrate it to the mystery. The conflict is between the science of 2000 BC and the science of AD 2000. And that's what we've got in the Bible, which is based on a Sumerian mythology.
David Kennard, what happens to a nation that has absolutely no mythology at all?
It's not a nation. It's a congeries of disparate people, not even a civilization.
But are there any of today's nations?
I'm not a sociologist. I don't keep up with the most recent things, so I just don't know.
Brown, what do you see as the difference between Freud's and Jung's points of view of the unconscious?
When Freud learned from Jung that there was a relationship between mythology and psychology, and you get this from their letters that have been published, Freud then started to study mythology from a standpoint of his psychology. The Freudian unconscious is a kind of scrap basket of repressed experiences that you can't tolerate, that you don't know how to assimilate. Consequently, for him, it's a function of your biography, do you see? So that your unconscious is a function of what you experienced before you even knew you were experiencing. We don't have the same symbol system. The Jungian unconscious is based on a biological point of view. The energies that inform the body are the energies that inform our dreams, but these dreams are inflected by our personal experiences. The Freudian unconscious, which Jung called the personal unconscious, is basically biographical, not biological. So Freud was trying to interpret the totality of mythological forms in terms of a historical crisis in the past. That's patricide, you know, in Totem and Taboo. In other words, he interprets the symbology in terms of historical and biographical events. Jung sees that, yes, that's one aspect of the psyche, but the other aspect is the energies of the organs, which are the same in all of us, moving us. That's what is called the collective unconscious. That's the unconscious that each of us shares. Mythic symbols come out of that depth, not out of the personal depth at all. Every mythology is, of course, oriented to a historical situation. It comes out of this people, this province, and that one and the other. And so there is that local inflection, but what is inflected are the deep energies of the total id. Adolf Bastian, a German anthropologist, has meant a great deal to me with just this main idea. He died around 1925. These common themes that come out of the collective unconscious he calls elementary ideas, but they always come to expression in specific social environments, and it's historically and geographically differentiated. He called those differentiations Völkergedanken, or ethnic or folk ideas. When you are in your youth, the folk idea guides you into the society you are inducted into for life. But there comes a time when life dismisses you, and then the folk idea unshells, you might say, the elementary idea, which guides you back. In India, in art criticism, these same two aspects of images are recognized. The folk aspect, which simply has to do with people and things and stories and time and space, is called desi, which means local, popular. On the other hand, the elementary ideas, when the deity is represented, are called marga, the path. Marga is a root word from merg, which refers to the footprints left by an animal, and you follow that animal. The animal that you are trying to follow is your own spiritual self, and the path is indicated in the mythological images. Follow the tracks of the animal, and you will be led to the animal's home. Who is the animal? The animal is the human spirit. Where is its home? It's in your own heart. So following the elementary idea, you are led to your own deepest spiritual source. And Jung asked himself by what mythology he was living, and he found he didn't know. And so he said, "I made it the task of tasks of my life to find by what mythology I was living."
Joseph Campbell, Esalen, 1982.
So the desi, the folk, guide you into life, and marga, the elementary, guides you to your own inward life. Mythology serves those two purposes that way. The elementary ideas do not change. Where do they come from? They come from the soul. The origin is the soul of man, marga. The problem is not to lose touch with them. And when the folk ideas that relate to a certain social order and structure are no longer functioning for that structure because another structure has come along, we are in psychological disarray. This is one of the problems today. These days, the social system and the social ideas, and also the physical environment, is changing so fast that there is no opportunity for a constellation, for a crystallization to develop. Just in my own lifetime, the transformations in terms of ethics and how people are expected to behave, well, it's prodigious. One afternoon when I was a very little boy, down here on 98th Street and Riverside Drive in New York City, my uncle came in and said, "Joe, we're going down to Riverside Drive to see a man fly an airplane from Albany to the Battery." And this was the longest flight ever. It was Glenn Curtis flying a sort of flying bicycle down the Hudson River. I remember standing along the street with all the people standing on buildings watching this thing happen. As the sun went down, it was twilight, and then we saw this thing coming, and everybody shouted, "There he is! There he is!" That was when I was a little boy. And then the year I left Columbia to go to study in France and Germany, 1927, was the year Lindbergh flew across the water in that little thing, the Spirit of St. Louis. You should see it in the St. Louis airport. And now they are on the moon. My God, just in terms of mechanics, it's a terrific job. Not only the actual act, but the notion of consciousness, the notion of man's relation to the universe is transformed by this. So we're in the middle of a big change. I had the real pleasure many years ago, 1954, of having an invitation to tea, my wife and I, with Dr. and Mrs. Jung. And this was at his place outside Zurich called Bollingen, after which the Bollingen Foundation was named. It's at the far end of Lake Zurich. So we stopped at a lovely little hotel and viewed that part of the area, and when it came time to go to Jung, we got in our car and drove down the road looking for Bollingen. I had driven a couple of miles when we asked one of the peasants at the side of the road, "Bitte, wo ist Bollingen?" "Bollingen ist hier entlang." "It's along here." Back I go this way and I see another chap, and then I say, "Bitte, wo ist Bollingen?" "Bollingen ist hier entlang." So this is the way I finally came to the place where it was, and it was a little road that ran off. We turned across that road and across the railroad tracks. Now the Swiss trains are silent and fast, and when we crossed that track, poof, behind us went the train. I said to Jean, "We've gone through the Simplegades. We've gone through the Klapfelsen. We're in the Holy Land now." We drove up to the place where Jung's little castle was that he had built with his own hands, this stone castle that was part of his opus to find what his mythology was. We drew up there and got out of the car and began walking up the path, but so many people had walked there that the path was worn too deep to reach the door. I didn't know how to get in. Well, Jean knows how to do things, so she finally found the bell and rang it, and we came in and were greeted by Dr. and Mrs. Jung. We had tea there, and now this is the man's character. No Herr Dr. Professor. He was just a genial host. I had no trouble with him because by that time I had published 4 volumes of Heinrich Zimmer's work. Zimmer was a friend of his, and Jung had published one of Zimmer's German works. So we were co-editors, you might say, of Heinrich Zimmer. Now, I was about to leave for India, and so Jung said, "Well, you're about to go to India. Let me tell you about the meaning of the syllable Om." I thought, "Well," he said, "when I was in Africa, a group of us went for a walk and we got lost. Pretty soon we realized that there was a group of young warriors around us, standing on one leg holding spears with things through their noses. We didn't know who they were. They didn't know who we were. Nobody could speak anybody else's language. And," Jung said, "after a rather embarrassing and troublesome moment, we all sat down. We all looked at each other, and when we all felt comfortable that everything was all right, what do I hear? I hear, Om, Om, Om." Then, he said, 2 years later, I was in India with a group of scientists. And if there's any group of people that is not susceptible to the experience of awe, this is it. We went up to Darjeeling and went to Tiger Hill. To get there, you have to leave early in the morning before dawn and are transported up the hill. You don't know what you're going to see. It's dark. Then the sun comes up, and infinitudes of snow-capped Himalayan peaks burst into rainbow colors. And what did I hear from the scientists? Om, Om, Om. Then Jung says, Om is the sound nature makes when it's in harmony with itself. I thought, that was all right. And so I went away to India. Jung was a beautiful man to be with. That's all I can say.
Arian, you speak of the mythology of youth as the mythology of moving into the world. But if in your youth you choose something that you wouldn't have chosen at age 35, do you go back and choose that? Do you stick with your original decision or move to the inward journey?
Is there any single rule that would work for everybody? If there was, it would be so easy to answer that question. The point is that every individual has his own very special problem in this midlife or late life crisis about what he has been doing. How deeply has it really involved him? Has he had other outside marginal interests of any kind whatsoever? What were they? All these are very special problems. Now, there's a moment in Jung's life when he had finished his work on his first great book, the book that Freud would not accept, Symbols and Transformation. This had to do with the imagery of a woman who was in deep psychosis. He began recognizing the analogies between her hallucinations and basic world mythological imagery. And Jung said when he finished work on the book, he realized what it meant to live with a mythology and what it meant to live without one. And he asked himself by what mythology he was living, and he found he didn't know. And so he said, I made it the task of tasks of my life to find by what mythology I was living. How did he do it? He went back to think about what it was that most engaged him in fascinated play when he was a little boy, so that the hours would pass and pass. Now, if you can find that point, you can find an initial point for your own reconstruction. Go back and find what was the real fascination. So Jung went back to boyhood and found that he loved to play with stones, making little villages. Then he went and bought himself a piece of property and began with his own hands building that amusing little castle that he had there in Bollingen on Lake Zurich. Now, each one has to work it out in his own way. But if a person just refuses to think that he has an inside problem, he's not going to work the thing out. Nobody can do it for him. You have to learn how to recognize your own depths.
Chapter 3. The Vision Quest.
What is it we are questing for? It is the fulfillment of that which is potential in each of us. Questing for it is not an ego trip. It is an adventure to bring into fulfillment your gift to the world, which is yourself.
Joseph Campbell, Pathways to Bliss. 2 weeks after Campbell returned to New York in October 1929 came the Wall Street crash. Unable to find a job and unwilling to resume the PhD program at Columbia, Joseph Campbell retired at the age of 25 to a friend's cabin in Woodstock, New York, with his sister Alice, a student of the Russian sculptor Alexander Arkhipyenko, to read and to try his hand at writing fiction. For the next couple of years, the callow young author, as he described himself, read voluminously and wrote unsuccessfully. A collection of his short fiction was finally published posthumously as Mythic Imagination. Finally, in 1931, he traveled in the family Model T Ford to California to look for a job. Through the young nutritionist Adele Davis, he met John Steinbeck and the biologist Ed Ricketts, who rekindled his interest in the relationship between mythology and biology. He sailed with Ricketts up the West Coast to Alaska on the Inside Passage, where they collected intertidal fauna, and Campbell played the balalaika with Russian gold miners. In 1933, he accepted a teaching job from his old master at Canterbury Prep School, but resigned at the end of the term and went back on the depression. Serendipitously, one of his short stories sold, a now long-lost piece called Strictly Platonic. On the $300 windfall he earned from the story, he returned to Woodstock for 2 more years of self-imposed exile, studying in depth the authors who had galvanized him in Europe: Joyce, Spengler, Mann, Freud, Jung, Frazier, and Frobenius. In spring of 1934 came a job offer from Sarah Lawrence College, which he immediately accepted. There, for the next 38 years, he taught enormously popular classes in comparative literature and mythology.
I think the most important period of my scholarship and study followed my return from Europe. I came back to the United States about 2 weekends before the Wall Street crash, and there wasn't a job in the world. I went back up to Columbia to go on with my work on the PhD and told them, "This whole thing has opened out." "Oh, no," they said. "You don't follow that. You stay where you were before you went to Europe." Well, I just said to hell with it. My father had lost all his money, but I had saved some as a student. I used to play in a jazz band, and so I piled up money during a few years. And on that, you might say, I just retired to the woods. I went up to Woodstock and just read and read and read and read for 5 years. No job, no money. I learned then that you don't need money to live if you're a young man who didn't get himself involved sooner than he should have, before he had the ability to support what his involvement might be. So during the years of the Depression, I had arranged a schedule for myself. When you don't have a job or anyone to tell you what to do, you've got to fix one for yourself. I divided the day into 4 four-hour periods, of which I would be reading in 3 of the 4-hour periods and free one of them. By getting up at 8 o'clock in the morning, by 9 I could sit down to read. That meant I used the first hour to prepare my own breakfast and take care of the house and put things together in whatever shack I happened to be living in at the time. Then 3 hours of that first 4-hour period went to reading. Then came an hour break for lunch and another 3-hour unit. And then comes the optional next section. It should normally be 3 hours of reading and then an hour out for dinner and then 3 hours free and an hour getting to bed, so I'm in bed by 12. On the other hand, if I were invited out for cocktails or something like that, then I would put the work hour in the evening and the play hour in the afternoon. It worked very well. I would get 9 hours of sheer reading done a day, and this went on for 5 years straight. You get a lot done in that time. When the job at Sarah Lawrence came, until I started writing, I continued that schedule over the weekends when I was at home. Reading what you want and having one book lead to the next is the way I found my discipline. I've suggested this to many of my students. When you find a writer who really is saying something to you, read everything that writer has written and you will get more education and depth of understanding out of that than reading a scrap here and a scrap there and elsewhere. Then go to people who influenced that writer, or those who were related to him, and your world builds together in an organic way that is really marvelous. Whereas the way these things are taught normally in college and school is a sampler of what this one wrote and that one wrote, and you're asked to be more interested in the date of the publication of Keats's sonnets than in what's in them. And so with those women students at Sarah Lawrence to help me, I broke completely away from the academic approach to these subjects. It was a grand, grand experience. I was a little nervous at times. I remember having a $1 bill in the top drawer and knowing I would not die as long as that dollar bill was there. And so various things turned up. I spent the year before I got the job teaching at Sarah Lawrence minding a dog for some people who had built a house at Woodstock, a beautiful little house. It was a great big dog, a kind of a cross between a police dog and a Doberman Pinscher, whose name was Fritz. I spent a year with this animal, and I learned a lot about dogs. He fell in love with a cat down the road, and I tried to condition his reflexing so that he wouldn't go down to the cat, and of course he found ways to get down there. That was one way of living life on no money.
Tarnas, I'd like to hear about the advantages of not having a Ph.D.
Well, it's not an advantage to be without a Ph.D., but it's an advantage not to have taken a Ph.D. because of the things that they do to you to get you into the slot that they want you in. Just at the time of your life when the stars are opening and your mind is opening to new thoughts, new things, they put you under the supervision of some professor who had his excitement, if he ever had it, a lifetime ago. Now, he's interested principally in the footnotes that you are handling. You know, it's dreadful. And so I have a theory that, yes, PhDs are all right in certain areas, but in the areas of the liberal arts, of culture, it's a sign of incompetence to have a PhD. I mean it. The time when you should have been finding your thoughts, should have been opening up and being excited at the stuff is exactly the time they bring the axe down on you. I can remember a wonderful professor at Columbia named Raymond Weaver. He's the one who rediscovered and re-edited Melville back in the 20s. And he had no Ph.D. When I decided I was going to go on to graduate work, he said, "Well, be careful, because they're going to flatten you out." And while I was working on it, an invitation came to accept the teaching position out in the Middle West. When I spoke to him, he said, "If the Ph.D. doesn't flatten you out, a job like that will." And those remain in my mind as very important clues for a learner from a marvelously civilized man. So I quit the Ph.D. because they didn't want to hear about Sanskrit. They didn't want to hear about modern art. They wanted to hear about the relation of Celtic myth to Arthurian romance. And I got over that. I remember that I just didn't have anybody to tell me what to read, and so I began pulling these things together. The realization I discovered during those years, Oswald Spengler's The Decline of the West, and the marvelous work of Leo Frobenius, seeing these men talking about historical forms, and seeing how it all went together with Jung and Freud and Mann and Joyce. Then I discovered Robinson Jeffers out there in California. Those were great illuminations. And I didn't have to write a thesis. I didn't have to write anything. All I did was underline sentences and take notes. It's funny. I spent about 40 years taking notes. I have 14 file drawers packed full of notes, and I never bother with them now anymore. The thing comes in that way. So when you don't have a job, and you are doing your own reading, you've got deep psychological questions, as deep as those of a little boy. And I thought, I don't want a job. So an invitation came from Sarah Lawrence to see if I wanted a job, and when I saw all the pretty girls, I said, yes, I want a job. Then a funny thing happened when I got the job. Namely, all my psychological problems disappeared.
Brown, did you have some sense that you were headed for a job as a teacher?
What happened with my mind was that I was enjoying so much just reading and doing what I wanted, without any goal out ahead other than that to which my reading was taking me. It was all this stuff that I'd found in Europe that was beginning to come together in the way that I can see it now. I didn't think I wanted a job or anything of the kind. And then came that one day when in the mailbox was this little letter from Sarah Lawrence inviting me down for a job. One of my professors at Columbia, W.W. Lawrence, from 3 years before, had recommended me as someone who would possibly be okay for this. Since I hadn't ever earned any money in my life, when I was asked, Mr. Campbell, what kind of salary do you want? I said, oh, I don't know. How about $2,000? And Constance Warren, the president of the college, said, we don't pay that little. So they paid me $2,200. When I hear what people start on now just falling out of the cradle, I can see that those were interesting times. The wonderful thing about Sarah Lawrence, and the reason I really took the job, was that the college had been founded only a few years before for young women. The college had just started, so I didn't have to fit into a slot. You know, teach this, and you're going to teach that, too. It had been founded as a women's college with the idea that women did not need or really want, nor were they properly served by, a spin-off on the male curriculum on the model of a male college. So the idea was that we should follow the interests of the students. Now that was a very interesting time. There was a big resource pool of academic people out of work. There were people coming over from Central Europe, with Hitler over there, and so a perfectly marvelous faculty was assembled. It really was. You have to have men and women of considerable sophistication to follow a student's lead and to be able to carry that person into the mainstream of the humanities out of his or her own impulse. That we did. Very soon the creative arts faculties built up. In those years, in the men's universities, if you wanted to study art, you studied the history of art. Here we had studios and the dance. Martha Graham teaching dance at Sarah Lawrence. I mean, this is what we had, a marvelous, marvelous school. To move in there and be able to give the courses that dealt with materials that had meant something to me during my 5 years of reading, and know that they would meet the needs of other young people was a real privilege, really great. So I took the job and was there for 38 years. It kept getting to be more and more instructive to me. I had to cut it down to only seniors so that I wouldn't have to make a selection, because I could teach only a certain number of people. We never had mass classes. I had to have interviews with every one of my students every fortnight, and so couldn't teach more than 20 people. I could see how it enriched all of their understanding of the work they were doing. As a male studying mythology, I had certain interests of my own. But at that college, not only did we follow the interests of the students, we found out what the interests were. In the half to three-quarter hour conference with every one of my students, I came to know personally what they were getting and what they wanted. I was forced by my female students to consider the material from the point of view of the woman. And that point of view had to do with, what does the material mean to life? What does it mean to me? I don't care why this myth occurred there and then over there, but not over here. What does it mean to me? When I was teaching, I would say I had almost a 50-50 split between Christians and Jews, and now and then Buddhists, Zoroastrians, and people of other kinds. And my first thought was that I am going to relieve them of their religion. But I found very soon that the result was exactly the opposite, that suddenly these religions, which had been presented to them as God is out there, had new messages. And I have known and met those students since, this started 40 years ago, and they're all mothers of children now. They tell me time and time again what the value of this thing opening out is. You don't lose your religion. You stay with what you've got, but certainly it can talk what I would say would be its original language before the clergy closed it off. In my thinking about the determination of the direction of my own thought, I have to give the credit to my students. What they did was in the way of keeping me on a beam that was a beam of the vitality of the subject. I think it's a shame what's happening now with the co-ed movement, this differentiation which is so important to human life. The difference between a male and female is being wiped out. All differentiations are being wiped out. You're almost not allowed to even have a club now. Anything like a differentiation is called elitism, and it's not enjoyed. But having had my 5 years of doing my own reading, and then 38 years of supplying young women with the vitality of the subject that I had found for myself, it was marvelous. Marvelous.
Arian, when I think about how much you learned about women after all those years of teaching...
I taught them for 38 years, and I still wouldn't want to say that I knew what they're all about.
Arian, not many people can say that they taught all women for 38 years. How many on this planet, in this culture, can say that?
I learned more than I taught, but it wasn't about women.
Arian, what was it about?
It was about teaching. Their attitude was very different than mine, and if my works are around and regarded as helpful and important, it's because of those young women. I know it. Now that was a great privilege.
Brown, did you have to deal with projection from the students?
I knew what the projections were, so that I knew it had nothing to do with me or them. It was just something going on. So I always called the students by their last name until I began to think of myself as a grandfather. Then I could begin to call them by their first names. The thing was to keep a good, cool front. Now, with a girl like Marilyn Monroe, the beauty is a kind of screen in front, and they feel nobody's getting through to them. I had about 4 students like that, and when they came into the room, I had to go to work just to talk to them properly. And you know then that you're just in the presence of something that is almost divine, and that's no good to you as a teacher. That's a curse. It's fascinating.
Brown, Joe, I know one of your students who is in her 40s now who swears she's never loved any man as much as you, even though she's been married 3 times.
Well, now, that's sweet of her.
Brown, each time to a very adequate man, she tells me, but always working in the background is Joe Campbell. What do you think about that?
That the serious side of teaching women comes from the fact that they did not let me, in teaching this subject of mythology, get off into all kinds of academic corners. They always wanted the material to relate to themselves, to life. And I attribute the popular aspect of my writing to that training I got from these students. They were wonderful.
Brown, how could you be sure they were getting the message?
My friend Heinrich Zimmer used to say that the radio station WOB, Wisdom of the Buddha, is broadcasting all the time. But you've got to have a receiving set. And until you have the receiving set, well, you're not getting the message. You can't teach Buddhism. You can't teach illumination. You can give different clues to how to get it. But if a person isn't willing to paddle his own canoe, he's not going to get across the river. Some people are just unable to experience the radiance, but they can listen to a lecture. I think it was Oscar Wilde who said if an American was given a chance to choose between going to heaven and hearing a lecture about it, he'd go to the lecture. And so if you're unable to experience heaven, you can take a lecture about it. And maybe that will save you. They say you can lead a girl to Vassar, but you can't make her think. They didn't say that about Sarah Lawrence.
Jamaica Highwater. Somewhere in your work, you mentioned the fact that you thought that very early on, humankind was actually in a perpetual dream state. What I'm wondering about is if this dream state, this art world which we all, I think, have such enormous regard for, has not in some way been dismissed as secondary, and that what your work really does is try to bring us back to the fact that this is not secondary, that this is primary. This is what it is to be alive. And isn't that what finally makes the Iliad and the Odyssey viable and important to us today? The symbols might be different, and the images may be different, but that which motivates those epics is still within us.
That whole problem of breaking out of the field of waking consciousness into a field of dream consciousness is a basic problem of ritual. Therefore, in sum, the monstrous, irrational, and unnatural motifs in folktale and myth are derived from the reservoirs of dream and vision. On the dream level, such images represent the total state of the individual dreaming psyche. But clarified of personal distortions and profounded by poets, prophets, and visionaries, they become symbolic of the spiritual norm for man, the microcosm. They are thus phrases from an image language, expressive of a metaphysical, psychological, and sociological truth.
Joseph Campbell, Commentary to The Complete Grimm's Fairy Tales.
I would say the main function of rites is to orient an individual to the dream consciousness level, which is the productive level, the second level area of Om, as it is interpreted in one of the Upanishads. Dream consciousness is further in, and it's a creative consciousness, whereas waking consciousness is a critical consciousness. It's a totally different logic. In the dreams, you are the dream. The most primitive people of the world, and they are almost extinct now, are the Bushmen of South Africa, who are hunters on the plains. The Pygmies are really gatherers, mainly in the jungle. They spend their nights in dances, and the men dance, and the women simply sit in the center and clap and guide them a little bit. But the men are going round and round in a very stiff manner with the expectation that they will flip out and go into a trance state. Among these people, there are always those who undergo a psychological crack-up, what's known as the shaman crisis, where the person goes down into the unconscious. Between the complete flipping out and the moment of loss of balance, they are in a position to cure, and then they go into the state. Now, we have descriptions that have been given by some of these men of what they experience in the trance state, and it is a whole mythology. Climbing the sky on those strands that the sun sometimes sends down, spider webs and things like this, and of who they meet up there. It's a whole mythology that comes right out of an inward experience and then becomes the mythology of the people. Not everyone goes into these trances, but they get the news of what's inside themselves from those ones who do go into trances. And then you have the shamanic experience of the northern peoples, the Siberians, and down in South America. And what it's associated with in the North and the Americas is the song. Every shaman has his song that takes him away. There have been descriptions of how a person first hears his or her song, walking along a seashore or being in a forest. There's this experience, and from then on, he's overtaken. There's an interesting paper, The Shaman from Elko, in the Festschrift novel volume for Joseph Henderson, a psychiatrist in San Francisco. It's an account of a woman in West Virginia, in the coal mining areas there, who in her late 60s had the dreadful feeling that she had lost life, that she had never lived life, that there had been a life for her that she had not lived. And in the analysis, they found one time when she was a little girl about 13 years old, that's about the time for the experience, she was walking in the forest and she heard a strange music, a strange song. But she didn't have in her culture the assistance to help her do something with that, and so she lost it. And then throughout her life, she had the feeling that she hadn't lived her life. The thing about the shaman crisis is that if the individual does not follow the song, he will die. He will really die. This is a strange psychological thing.
Stanislav Grof. In this society, many of the states the shamans go through would be labeled as psychotic. The career of many shamans starts by the powerful experience of unusual states of consciousness, with the sense of going into the underworld, being attacked, dismembered, and then being put back together, and ascending to the supernal realm. If you look at these experiences and give them psychopathological labels, those in our culture undergoing a shamanic transformation wouldn't typically be allowed to complete it. High water. How would we apply that kind of knowledge, which is so remote from this moment, in this dominant society? How would we apply it to life as we live it today?
I think the thing in our own experience is the person who, in youth, has the sense of a life to live, and then Daddy says, "No, you'd better study law, because there's money in law." No, I mean it. I think this is exactly the counterpart. And you meet those people later on, and they are the ones who have climbed to the top of the ladder and found it's against the wrong wall. They have not lived their lives.
High water. My people say it in a different way, but which is exactly the same. They say, "Do not be afraid of what you're becoming."
That's right.
Betty Andreessen. You talk about the decision to follow your bliss or your song during the crisis of youth. How about somebody who didn't have this courage at that time? Is that perhaps a midlife crisis? And is it too late if you miss the boat at 35?
According to the Gospels, it's never too late for salvation. That was a nice question she put to me.
Arian, it was. And not only was it a nice question that she put to you, it's going to reach a lot of people who have this same crisis.
Exactly.
Andreessen, I know so many people who are in the same boat I was in a few years back. They need that validation that says, follow your bliss. But I can remember being told in Sunday school that if the road is hard and rough and you're suffering, then you're on the right track.
That's the wrong one.
Andreessen, it was the wrong one, and, I mean, it was painful.
I got this from the Sanskrit idea that transcendence is transcendent. Now, there are three words that come close to it. Sat-chit-ananda. That is, sat is being, chit is consciousness, ananda is bliss. So, ananda is the only thing you can be aware of. Follow it, and it'll be all right. The probability is that when you follow it, everything will work out, even if you think it won't.
Andreessen, I understand that more and more because as I do that, as you say, doors that were never there open.
It really works. They open.
Andreessen, so is the midlife crisis, which a lot of people are experiencing in their early 30s or maybe mid-30s, is it that they are finally realizing that the ladder was up against the wrong wall? That perhaps this is the last chance?
I would think that likely, but the midlife crisis, like any other late-life crisis, is that of unshelling a system of life and immediately moving into a new system of life. Because if this life is unshelled and you don't have a new intention, there is a total disorientation. This, I think, is the big problem in retirement. And it's going to be more of a problem now that retirement's being made earlier and earlier and earlier. The life in which you have involved yourself fully has suddenly been moved. And so, what? I'm told that the life expectancy of a blue-collar worker after retirement is around 5 years. That means that his body says, "You've got nothing for me to do, so let's say goodbye." Following your bliss just seems to me to be the clue to believing what might be called the mythologically inspired life. I've had the experience of teaching young women for many, many, many years, and occasionally you would see someone wake up right there in front of you. A wonderful moment in pedagogical experience. And then you meet the person 5 years, 10 years, 20 years later at the alumni reunions, and you can see the difference between the woman who had been able to follow her star and the woman who had married into an archetypal marriage situation where now she is the wife of the family and doing all the chores that have nothing to do with what she originally intended for her life. You can see it when you meet them, the vitality that's in them. Those who are fortunate enough to be artists and move into a field that is always evoking the life of the imagination are the ones who have the easiest time, I guess. But that's not the only way to live your life of bliss.
Arian, that is so important. Many people don't follow their song through those different transitions. They want